The emotional, social, and physical development of young children has a direct effect on their development and on the adults they will become. For this podcast, we've compiled 6 different stories on particular childhood experiences from people here in San Antonio. Inner City Development is a community-based organization that serves the educational and recreational needs of the 78207 community. Reporters Arisela Mendez, Tracy Lopez, and Tony Wilson interview multiple people on how the organization helped affect their lives.
I feel that this is a beautiful program for the entire community, and definitely I wish that there were other communities, not just the west side of San Antonio, that had a program like this. It's more of a family program because inner city becomes a family, and I wish that it was around everywhere else.
That was Elizabeth Vega, who participated in activities as a child and is now the Secretary for Inner City Development. Since 1958, Inner City Development continues to serve as a nonprofit organization in the west side of San Antonio. The program provides assistance for the community and allows opportunities for teens and adults to volunteer through various activities, from feeding the homeless to hosting community festivals that provide funding for the organization. It serves an area where 40% of the people are below poverty. Almost all volunteers have been associated with an organization since they were children and teens.
I hope that my children will get experience in giving their time and volunteering. And I hope that one day that they'll still be active. And I hope the inner city stays along. We've been here 50 years, so I hope that we can stay another 50 years. And I hope that they can come back and give as well.
The organization has not only been an improvement and much needed impact on the less financially stable areas of the west side of San Antonio, but has also become a major part of people's lives. From the kids who grew up relying on the organization to the volunteers who worked there since they were two kids just relying on inner city. Not saying there's anything wrong to rely on outside help when needed, but with an organization like Inner City, the help never feels like it's from the outside. It feels like it's from a helping hand within the family. We took an opportunity to ask a few lifelong volunteers, including Vega, what their greatest memories were from the program as children and how it has shaped them into their adulthood with the help of founders Patty and Rod Rattle.
Well, actually, through Inner City, I was homeschooled here in middle school, and Patty allowed me and 8 other individuals to go to New Orleans, and we went to California, and we would just go out of San Antonio, Barton Springs, we'd go to Dallas, NASA, we'd go to Houston on little trips. So that made me want to get older and get out of San Antonio and, of course, come back.
Rosa Lopez was one of the adults that chaperoned Vega on these trips. Lopez dedicated her time to the program since she was 7 and earned her first employment opportunity when she was 13. She was a single mother of 6 and found that inner city paved the way to help raise her children.
I was around 11 years old when we met Patty and Rod. And they came into our neighborhood. We used to live in the Alexander Apache Courts. They used to take us to their house, and we used to do a lot of arts and crafts and little things that would take us to little field trips. And then I was a single mother, and I had to go through a lot to see them grow. And they all graduated from high school, and after high school, what they wanted to do, it was up to them. They had a choice to go to college, but they all turned out to be good kids. All my kids are real good.
So many communities fall victim to not having a safe place for at-risk youth and even young adults to escape their toxic environments and could even fall through the cracks. As someone who has seen so many people lose their way to drugs and violence, Martha Hernandez kept herself out of the streets because of this program.
I never did drugs because I had something to do. And if people don't have something to do, they go into that stuff. And I never tried drugs.
Through the Spring Basketball League at Inner City, Richard Diaz was introduced to the fundamentals of the sport at the age of 7. His coaches taught him the disciplinary skills to build his character and instilled them into his daughter, who is now graduating high school from the top of her class.
We got in trouble in school, we had to go shoot free throws. Free throws, go shoot free throws, free throws, free throws.
And how long would you have to shoot the free throws?
1,000 free throws.
And your arms are hurting?
Nah, it wouldn't hurt. I was just used to it, but like if I get home from school, my brother was shooting free throws, I was like, I tell him, what did he do? And vice versa. And I was always shooting free throws because I was always getting in trouble. Like, why is everybody throwing free throws? So he didn't listen in school. Other than that, so that was our punishment. but that's how we got started with Inner City.
For a community that supports itself as much as it can, giving back is a high importance for the volunteers. And Fernando Sales, who has been involved for close to 50 years, expressed this sentiment.
It's part of giving back to the community. You have to give. You can't just take in life and not give back. You got to give back, or else what are you here for? If you're just going to be greedy and take and take and not give anything back to the people, especially people that need it and deserve it. They need a chance also just like anybody else.
Let's talk about the cultural history of the west side of San Antonio. We have reporter Raul Plata and Renee Orozco to talk about what they found cultivating on the west side.
The key unlocking the cultural history of San Antonio's west side is the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center. Census information from 2017 shows that the 78207 zip code, the area around the center, is 93.2% Hispanic, with a poverty level of 39.8%. On a recent trip to the Education Center at 723 South Brazos Street, we met Belinda Menchaca, Director of Education at the Guadalupe Center. She has been with it for more than 25 years and discussed how the center got its start.
The Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center came to be because there was great need in this neighborhood. Visual artists and performing artists, they were gathering to teach and to share their stories and to have a voice. And in 1981, that's when it became the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center. But it was out of a need for expression, a need for to have a voice. You know, so there was a lot of arts and culture happening throughout the city, but as far as our Latino voices, there was a huge need.
Developers of the center wanted to bring programming like Latino theater to the stage, as well as musical and performing arts classes. While speaking about the center, Menchaca also brought up one of her favorite students, Ali Grijalva.
Grijalva, a current member of the dance program, an 11-year veteran, is a lifelong West Side resident who has had dance in her life since she was a little girl.
So I actually started dancing when I was 4, and I started with like tap and ballet and stuff like that. And then my mom felt like it was something that I really needed to do in order to be connected with my culture. So I started dancing at a smaller studio when I was 7.
Her mother found the Guadalupe and fell in love with it. She enrolled Allie in the program, and since then, dance is a big part of her life.
I think it was the best decision she could have made for me because I've been here for 11 years now, and it really is like my second home. Being here is my life. I've grown in my culture, I've grown as a leader, I've grown in my ability to articulate why I'm so passionate about the things that I am. I'm really passionate about working with kids in this area and just really giving back to the community, I think, has been instilled within me as well as culture.
In addition to being a member, Ali is also a newly appointed apprentice with the dance program. Through this, she is seeing the program from a different perspective than she is normally used to.
Belinda always describes it as being a sponge and soaking in everything that you can until you basically like put in your time and you learn enough, and then you would become a full company member. So it's attending rehearsals and performing and everything that they would do. I think a very like intangible thing that I've learned is a love for like the people who surround me, and just that unconditional support has really been given to me here. And then passing that on to, like, the younger generations.
During the visit, Menchaca also brought in a parent who has a child participating in the program.
Proudest moments. I mean, I want to cry every single time.
That's Danielle Hasso, a mother of 3 children enrolled in the dance program at the center. She talks about her oldest daughter, Juliana, and her performances with her group.
Just seeing her shine, being out there, growing from being a 7-year-old that was probably in the back of the group to now being in the front where she shines. I have 2 aunts that danced when they were kids. I have an aunt that still dances flamenco now. And so for her to continue on dancing, I feel like it's something that my family can continue doing. And I feel like it brings out all the cultural stuff that I want them to learn, want her to learn. I don't want that to be lost. Having people come up to me after performances and say, "Your daughter dances wonderful," is probably the best feeling in the world.
Juliana Hasso, a member of the program for 8 years, had a similar motivation as Allie.
As a kid, I didn't really have much to do after school. I would just go home, do my homework, and then nothing from there. And my mom decided that it would be good for me to find new friends and find a different hobby that I might like or have interest in. I just really love dancing, and it gives me a time to express myself and show my happiness and fill the room with it. Sometimes we'll have different performances in farther places, and we'll talk about our nerves and we're ready to perform and we don't want to mess up, but we're super excited and our dancing just makes us so happy.
Menchaca truly believes in the importance of the center as it continues to teach traditions of Latino culture.
Our theater, the Guadalupe Theater, is a gem. And, you know, if we can get more people to come to our events and to learn about our wonderful culture, our rich culture, and to be proud of our heritage, whether you're Latino or not, you need to be very, very proud of who we are and who we stand for and the wonderful messages that we have to share with the world.
So has the center affected people?
I think it really impacted her life. It made her grow as a person, growing into a young woman. She's a wonderful multitasker, a wonderful student in school. You know, they say being part of a group or something bigger always helps you grow as a person, and it just teaches you a lot of things, and it's taught her a lot of things.
The Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center, a center that's changing lives one step, one note, and one line at a time.
Now we have reporters Carl Fears and Stephanie Marquez, who went to talk to residents who lived out certain stereotypes of the South Side and how some overcame their struggles that went along with it.
Every city has a neighborhood that is avoided by residents from other areas because of preconceived speculations and misconceptions such as high crime, drug abuse, and/or poverty. The South Side of San Antonio, according to some, fits this description. However, many of those who live on the South Side consider this place sacred, remembering a time when it was also simple. Southside residents look back 50 years ago to when they were children playing outside their homes and neighbors would watch out for one another. A few weeks ago, we ventured out into a Southside neighborhood near Arnold Park to talk to people about their childhood experience. People from the Southside, born and raised from that place that's called Dangerous.
A rebel of the Southside, 60-year-old Roger Hernandez makes his daily laps around Arnold Park that features soccer fields, a small walking track, and a playground. He considers his childhood a rocking experience.
Tell me about, like, what was it like growing up in the Southside for you?
To me, badass.
Yeah? tell me why.
Why? Because I can do anything I want without getting in trouble, you know.
Yeah.
Other than that, it's all right.
Like, what kind of stuff would you do without getting in trouble?
Without getting in trouble? Almost everything, because I never got caught. The schools were cool. Harlandale was badass. Just got away with a lot of stuff.
Someone who had met Hernandez back in the day would have probably considered him a reason why people might avoid the South Side. He turned himself in for arson and recounts his life of crime.
My brother was dating a girl in the apartments over here, where there was apartments, and I was partying with a friend there. I was having a good time, and then, I don't know, we just got out of there, and these two guys didn't like us, and a lot of people knew us in the apartments, and everybody talked to us, party with us, they didn't like us, they just didn't like us, and they stabbed my brother in the back. We were there, and then that time that my brother used to wear those shoes like Kiss, big suckers. And he started running, but I had to push him because he couldn't run. And I pushed him, and he still got stabbed in the back. And then I got hit with a pipe, but they didn't do nothing to me. I got up, and I said, "Hey, you suckers, Geronimo, don't forget, I'll be back." So they took my brother in the ambulance, and I went back. I said, "Now how am I going to take care of this business?" So I went and got me a couple of cases of quartz, finished them, then load them up with gas and rags and shit. And they only had an apartment, and they only had one door. You can only come one that door and go out that door. No two doors, one door. And they left us in the doors upstairs. So I sit in there, smoking now, drinking, all right, rock and roll. It's time for damage. I went and went over there. The whole thing got in flame. When they were jumping out, I was with my pipe. Boom, boom, beating the shit out of it. I was mad. But then down to my brother when they hit me. If they would have knocked me out, they would have beat the shit out of me. But they didn't. And I took like 3 months. I went and turned myself in. And you know what? The bad part about it? That's when the arson's just about to start it.
So you started the arson?
I guess so. I told her I was Geronimo. How? So I waited like 2 months. I went and turned myself in.
Many families experience their fair share of hardships. Southsider Joanne Archoa gave insight into the struggles she endured. At the age of 4, Archoa would flee her mother's wrath by sleeping under the Mission Concepcion Bridge until she was married at 18 years of age.
My mom would tear up my books, school books. She'd burn them in a bonfire in the backyard so I wouldn't do my homework, so I wouldn't go to school. So I wouldn't pass, so I wouldn't graduate. She did everything to try to keep me from graduating because she was a mean individual. Because she said, what are you gonna graduate for? You're just gonna get pregnant and have a bunch of kids. And I said, I'm not you, Mom. You had 11 kids. Had about a third or fourth grade education. I said, I'm not you and I won't be like you. I'm gonna graduate from high school. If I gotta sleep under the bridge at the river at Concepcion Park, which is where I spent most of my childhood, from age 4 till 18 when I got married. I spent many hot days, cold days, rainy days, hungry, under the bridge at Concepcion Park.
Her empowering story lets everyone know that if you don't give up and continue to move forward, one can overcome the stereotypical Southside cliches.
My dad was blind. He worked at Kelly Air Force Base for 43 years. He got his GED when he was 45 years old because it was important to him, a poor blind man, to have that piece of paper that said he had the equivalency to a high school diploma. And I would take him on the bus down to Fox Tech Night School, and he completed his GED. He earned his GED when he was 45 years old. I was 15 years old. And I said to my daddy, Daddy, if it takes me till I'm 40, I promise you, I will get a college degree if it takes me till I'm 40, Daddy. It took me 10 years to get my degree. Not because I didn't have the brain power, because most of what I learned, it was not really learned because I already knew it. But it took me 10 years to get my degree. My last 3 semesters, I took 3 college courses each semester in mathematics to get my degree. Nobody thought I'd make it. I made it because I wanted my degree by the time I was 40. I graduated in December of 1993. I turned 41 April the 3rd of 1994. I did my student teaching when I was 41 years old, and I got my first teaching job when I was 41 years old.
Before Southwest Military had various restaurants, shopping centers, before Toyota and the newly built Texas A&M San Antonio University were established, there was only Monte, nature's own undeveloped and wooded playground where children swung on trees, splashed in rain puddles, and swam in rivers created by the rain because of poor street infrastructure.
Yeah, the Bigfoot Street used to be like a river. When it rained, you could go swimming in there. It was about this high because the size of the street, the grass and the ground was about this high, you know, and it came down like this, and that's Bigfoot Street, you know, so when it rained, it'd be stayed about this way, so If it rained, we were all into the water, the whole neighborhood.
Gus Ramos, the eldest Southside native we spoke with, sitting at 80 years old, remembers a simpler time when the Southside was full of neighborhood kids playing together in the streets.
Well, back in those days, it was better. There wasn't that much law. The streets were not paved. Any place where there was no houses built was like a park for us, you know, go out there and play, fly a kite, play baseball, whatever we wanted to do. It was cheaper too. We didn't make much money, but $10 brought fetch you the whole month, you know. So it was pretty good.
The childhoods of the good old days are what keeps its residents reminiscing the easy and hard times. The values of the Southside revolve around memories of a tighter-knit community, family unity, and the courage of overcoming any obstacles. Despite the harsh rumors, the Southside is home to many of its residents. Many have come and gone, but most have come back to stay.
Fighting to stay out of trouble and growing up with a family tradition that lives on in San Antonio. A father growing up in the ring of boxing inspires his young son to do the same. We bring you with reporter Miguel Garcia and Jonathan Quisada with the full story.
Across the ring fighting tonight out of the blue corner, he's wearing black with silver and weighed in at 124.75 pounds. Undefeated, he has two wins. Both of his wins come by way of knockout. Ladies and gentlemen, from San Antonio, Texas, here he is.
On February 23rd, 2019, Rick El Castigo Medina had his third professional fight after over 100 amateur fights in his career. Starting at the age of 8, Rick Medina Sr., dad, had immersed his son into the boxing community, coming from his own experience in the sport.
I was actually born in Nueva Rosita, Coahuila, Mexico, and I've lived in San Antonio all my life since I came over when I was like 6 months old. So I was raised here in San Antonio.
I asked Rick Sr. what his life was like growing up in San Antonio around the ring.
As a young teenage kid, and I trained in amateur stuff on and off. Basically for myself, it was just to stay out of trouble. So that's how it came about. And then when I knew I was gonna have a son, I was hoping he'd want to box. Actually, what I remember is him being younger. When he was about 5-6 years old or so, I would always want him to go with me to the gym, and he would never want to. He'd always tell me no and no. And so I left it at that, and then one day he just, out of the blue, asked me if he could try training. So I was like, yeah, sure. So we started training, and then I got him ready for his first fight at 8 years old. And that's when I said, you know, I told myself, I was like, well, this is where we'll find out if you really want to do this. So, yeah, he had a tough first fight, and he had his first loss, and he came back stronger. He wanted to train more. So from there, it just went on.
Through the trials and tribulations of training, a new era in his career had begun with the integration into the Ramos Boxing Gym.
Okay, well, my name is Arturo Ramos. I'm from San Antonio, Texas. And we've been involved. Our team has been a registered club since 1995. And before then, we kind of, my dad coached at different gyms around San Antonio, and that started back in the 70s.
That's Arturo Turney Ramos Jr. He would become Medina's new mentor.
Yeah, boxing. Boxing is a tradition in our family. It's been passed on since my grandfather, and on to my father, and then eventually it got to me, and now we're in Arturo Ramos IV, you know, so we've all been involved in boxing.
It all begins in a similar fashion when you're a part of a familial structure.
You know, that my most, my memory is started with about the age of 11 or 12 when I started competing. You know, that's when but before then, you know, I was always involved in boxing in one way or another.
Turney saw potential in Rick through his previous experience, and now he's begun to see a bit of himself in Rick. He has a certain way of looking at him.
Well, now I feel like if I compliment him, I'm going to be a little selfish. but as far as, you know, Rick's skills, he has all the skills needed to reach whatever goals he decides to go after, you know.
As far as skills go, Turney sees the specifics.
I think his strongest punch might be that left hook, you know, but he's also knocked guys out with the right hand, so it's whatever lands.
Beginning at a young age, Rick sees boxing as normal. He was surrounded by the culture and sees it very simple.
It's fun, you know, it's I grew up with it my whole life, so it's just been there, so I adjusted to it, and it's always been my thing.
Rick is constantly on a training schedule when he comes in with a certain mindset every time.
Just, I'm ready to work. I see everybody working. Just come ready to work. Just know that my opponent's doing the same thing, so I just gotta be even more prepared.
It all comes from what he has seen in his family, hard work.
Makes me feel good, you know, seeing my parents work hard. It makes me want to work hard, you know, work hard coming from a working family. So it makes me even want to work harder, seeing them work for me, for our family.
The jumping off point took Rick for a spin with his eagerness to compete.
Well, my first couple fights, you know, they were tough. I just wanted to jump in the ring. So I learned my lesson, you know. I took a couple losses my first couple fights, and I learned how to lose. So I think that was a good thing, you know, learning how to lose before I started winning.
After 4 rounds of boxing, we go to the judges' scorecards, and all three judges, Joel Elizondo, Ursulo Perez, and Glenn Crocker, scored the same, 40-36, all in favor of your winner by unanimous decision, Rick.
After his fight, Tim Schieff of Off the 10 Sports caught up with Rick and asked him a few questions.
So, Rick, you won in 4 rounds, unanimous decision by the judges against Jose. How do you feel?
I feel good. Got the W, so that matters. Feeling good.
So it seemed like Cassiano's goal was to get inside where your reach wouldn't be as much of an advantage, but it seems like you were ready and waiting for that.
I noticed he was trying to crowd me. So I just kept boxing him, and it was working for me, establishing the jab. It was landing every time. I got the W. So.
He seemed to be dropping his right hand, giving you an opening with right at him, and you were taking advantage of that a lot. Was there anything that he was doing well that you were struggling with?
No, I felt everything was in my favor, felt good.
Hey, Rob! Get one together, Rick. Get one with Greg, right here. Take one, Rob. Here we go.
But what are your thoughts on the fight? How do you think your son did?
He did great. We knew this kid was that wanted to stay. This kid that he was fighting, Cassiano, was wanted to stay in the inside and fight close and fight the typical Mexican fight, which is just bang it out. But this guy just we told him he had to box and use his boxing skills and move and pick his shots.
Yeah. So, sitting down, watching a recording of the fight days later, reminded Turney of the differences in this fight.
From the beginning, I mean, from the very beginning, he was. I think the only surprising thing. I mean, everything went as planned. I mean, the only thing that was a little different from the other fights is that usually when you land a shot on these other guys, they get hurt, they go down. You know, with this guy, he's a tough little guy, man. He came to fight. You know, he came to earn his paycheck. You know.
What do you think? What's kind of running through your head looking back on the fight?
In the fourth round.
Well,
or just in?
Just watching this.
It was different for me. You notice when you watch videos, you notice
like stuff you didn't even realize you were doing.
Like what do you realize? What are you looking at?
Just like how comfortable I look. Just all the little movements you're doing, you don't really, like they just come natural in the fight and you don't, and once you watch it back, you notice all the things you worked on.
Living Abroad is a story about moving from place to place as a child. Reporters Valerie Champion, Gabriel Tejas, and Kayla De La Pena interviewed six adults to explore their experiences as they traveled around as children.
The concept of home is an ideal hard to realize for those who grew up moving from neighborhood to neighborhood. Moving around can cultivate a sense of hope, or lack thereof, for a permanent place to call home.
Jose Untalan was born on the remote island of Yap, located in the Pacific Ocean, at a time in which the Second World War and local Japanese military presence heavily influenced the lives of islanders. His early childhood neighborhood was plagued by chaos and uncertainty, thanks to Japanese soldiers seeking to exploit local islands like Yap for shelter and resources.
During the war, I was 4 years old. I remember a lot, especially in the middle of the war, you know. One thing that I remember is the Japanese, during the war, they kicked us out of the house. The Japanese took over, taken to headquarters, and took all our livestock and everything that we have.
Jose explained that, by the orders of Japanese occupants, older children on the island were put to work to clean up the airfield, while younger children were to be shipped off to the nearby island of Guam.
Then I went 1946, like I say, I went to Guam with three of my brothers and two sisters to go to school because we didn't have good school, and I was 9 years old. So they sent us that, said, okay, go on the LSD 448.
Jose described a harrowing trip on the LSD 448, the cargo ship that carried his family and many others from one island to the next. The memory of the turbulent sea is still fresh in his mind. The promise of safety and an education just over the horizon. No matter the circumstances, a sudden move from one's childhood home can be a distressing experience for a child, and the effects can be even more impactful later in life if such an event continues to occur throughout their youth. Growing up, Dominique Gonzalez never had a place to call her permanent childhood neighborhood. Even before her mother was married into the military, Dominique was already being moved around the city of San Antonio, where she was born.
Probably about four when I moved out, or when we moved out, and we moved back in with my grandma for like a year or so, and then I started school and my mom found another apartment, actually really far away from my school. So I was late to school like every day.
Even at such a young age, Dominique became accustomed to changing environments. But with her new father's career in the U.S. Army, suddenly Dominique would be forced to move far beyond the city she grew up in, the city she called home for most of her childhood. This would present unique challenges for her over the course of several years.
And then once they got married, we would move like out of state and out of the country at one point. So you either like become really good at making friends or you become really awkward like I do. It's really uncomfortable in a lot of social situations because I never like stayed in a place long enough to have those like deep friendships.
This constant moving would only come to a halt during her early 20s when she found the independence to anchor herself in one place. This would come in the form of Schertz, Texas, mere miles from the city she was born in.
In some ways, I think it's positive in that I was really self-sufficient as a kid, just because, like, figuring out new places and stuff. I think it definitely has some, like, negative effects, though. As far as lasting relationships go, I don't have very many because I would move away so quickly.
Conversely, moving from the country to the city can also be a confusing experience for a kid. Sarah Klassen's parents separated soon after she was born. She lived on the north side of San Antonio with her mom, and in Spring Branch, Texas, about 45 minutes north of San Antonio, with her dad. Klassen remembers a sharp contrast between living in the city and living in the hill country.
We could do whatever we want. There wasn't a lot of people that lived out there, so it was a trusted little community. You know, we'd run down to the creek or to the Guadalupe River and swim, and you know, as long as we were back before dark, my dad was cool with it. We didn't have phones and stuff. It was just very free. When I came to my mom's house in the city, you know, it was like we went to school here and, well, for some of it, but it was much more, you know, we had a lot more, like, guidance.
For Klassen, country living meant freedom on many fronts.
I was a little girl, and, you know, I was just that little kid that was always, like, food all over my face and dirty hands, dirty feet running around in my diaper out there in the country. And my dad was okay with that because we were little country girls, you know. We were just messy and always playing outside. And the chickens there would, you know, I would follow them around and wait for them to poop, and I liked to eat it. And my dad would get really mad about that, that I would eat the chicken poop. And he told me, Sarah Jo, don't eat the chicken poop. And I would go and find the chickens, and he couldn't find me, you know, and he'd come looking for me, and there I'd be, you know, with chicken poop on my face, and I just loved it, couldn't get enough of it.
It was in the city, however, where Klassen would begin using drugs and alcohol.
When I was 10 years old, we would sneak out into the, here in the city with my mom, we'd sneak out into the garage and huff the gasoline. My sister was 3 years older than me, but we were very, very close, so her and her friends were doing it, so of course I wanted to do it, and I did it, and it was just the funnest thing in the world, and we got all high and, you know, laughed, and it was just the funnest. And then when I was 12, I would sneak out at my dad's house and go down the street, you know, to our friends, these older guys, and drink. My first drink was Purple Passion, and we listened to Tom Petty and drank Purple Passion, and it was definitely, you know, the off to the races after that. I full-blown alcoholic by the time I was 16 and just continued to drink and do drugs forever. But it definitely started out there, you know, and we didn't have, you know, my mom would play poker on the weekends, and, you know, she was involved with her friends and they were drinking. And so we didn't really have a lot of, you know, parents like watching us and telling us what to do. We had a lot of our own time and our own rules. And we just, unfortunately, like, took advantage of that and drank and did a lot of drugs.
Sheila Vasquez was born in Akron, Ohio. When she was still a baby, her mom stayed behind in Ohio, her dad joined the army, and she was raised by her paternal grandparents on the south side of San Antonio. Vasquez has fond childhood memories of going out to eat with her grandfather. Vasquez moved to Germany at age 9. She remembers celebrating her birthday in a hotel room while her dad and stepmom were waiting for their quarters to be ready.
There was no, like, billboards and, like, you know, it was just, like, forest and old churches, like, thousands of years old that I got to see, and, like, fucking castles. Like, there's no castles in, like, Texas, you know, like, just, you know, it's just, like, a different habitat even over there, you know, and, like, climate.
Other than having to walk uphill in the snow to get to school, Vasquez's most distinct memory of her time in Germany involves excess chores and a haunted stairwell with lights that worked on a timer.
So I remember having to do the laundry, and I was, like, tired, and I was like, oh, fine. It was, like, cold and dark. So I had the basket in my hand, and I, like, turned on the light, and I went downstairs. But, like, I guess I went slower than usual, and the light turned off as I was going down the stairs. And I slid. I was like, oh, and I ended. Okay, and get this. Okay, once you get down, the laundry room is actually the boiler room. And before you get to the boiler room, there's this long hallway. And I was always expecting to see, like, some kind of shadow, you know, like, there, because I've seen too many horror movies even at that age.
Growing up separately from the rest of her family while in Germany made Vasquez feel like the black sheep of the family. She experienced a disconnect from her original neighborhood on the south side. This included gaining an irrational fear of certain local women after her father warned that some could be gang affiliated.
Growing up, my dad, I would always be like, I want to go back to grandma's, like, you know, and he would be like, no, you know, there's dangerous people over there. There's cholas and they'll beat you up. They'll eat you alive. And so, like, they made me scared of, like, my own culture and, like, of cholas. So, like, they're like, you're going to be in a gang. And I was like, what? I don't want to be in a gang. I just want to go live with my grandma. In a way, I did. I missed my family a lot, like my grandparents and stuff. But I was always scared of that a little bit. And so, like, once we moved away to, like, Germany, I feel like I always had this distance from them.
Growing up romanticizing your first neighborhood, resenting your family for moving from one to another, trying to escape through drugs and alcohol, or growing as a person despite being uprooted are all common experiences for people who call multiple neighborhoods their childhood homes.
San Antonio being one of the fastest growing cities has brought about a lot of change over the years. Reporters George Esposo and Tessa Pena spoke to those who have witnessed firsthand the development of the city and its people.
Childhood memories and reflecting on the past can stir up a wide range of emotions. For some people, their childhood experiences are remembered as warm, happy images they would like to relive again and again. For others, their childhood experiences and neighborhoods were not fond memories. We interviewed seven San Antonians who grew up in downtown and southeast side communities. They shared some of their childhood experiences and memories of their neighborhoods. The one thing they all talk about is change.
Tina Morales is a retired Kelly Air Force Base employee, born and raised on the city's east side. Morales used to love that her neighborhood was multicultural with both Spanish and English speakers, where she was fortunate to learn English before beginning school.
I never knew we were poor. I guess I could say it that way. We never considered ourselves having to have something that someone else had. The neighborhood kids were always playing together. And we had the adults. I mentioned the lady. Nobody could go past her house without her asking the parents if they knew which way we were headed. And normally we went to the mom and pop store that was just about two blocks away, but it was on the main street, which was Seguin Road, which still exists. So we couldn't go past her house. Back then we kind of, she was tattling on us, was the way we used to say it. But she took care of us, because now we value that. As we were growing up, we kind of valued it.
Morales talked about how her childhood neighborhood was broken up and divided in two with the construction of a new highway, I-35.
The neighborhood has changed. Some of the houses still exist. And now a lot of them are being remodeled because of the east side growth and renovation. And my home doesn't exist anymore. About a year ago, I think we visited that area, and I was very disappointed. I was brokenhearted. That just kind of disappointed me, because I had many happy memories of my old neighborhood.
Patricia Gonzalez is a 58-year-old native San Antonian who grew up in the heart of the city's downtown area. Gonzalez said she watched from her home and witnessed a major part of San Antonio's skyline as it was being built.
I remember watching the Tower of the Americas coming up when it was just basically a big pole-looking thing going straight up, and slowly the top part was being craned up to the top and installed in place. I was pretty young at the time. I was probably about 5 years old.
We talked to someone a little younger than Gonzalez, but he has also seen a lot of changes since he was a child. Ryan Lloyd was raised in a rural part of San Antonio's southeast side, and the biggest change he sees is that there are a lot more businesses in his old neighborhood, which makes life more convenient now than when he was a kid.
I remember one Christmas, my dad got me this train set, and it had like some problems, so we had to go back to Windsor Park Mall or whatever and exchange it. And then we went back home, and then there were more problems. We like did that like five times, like that day, on Christmas Eve or whatever. Like went back and forth to our house, and then it's like a 25-minute drive every time. And now it's like changed, because there's like a lot more stuff around the south side, so there's City Base. And if that had been there when I was growing up, I mean, you wouldn't have to like drive all that way out. So I think it just speaks to how the city has focused attention on the south side and, you know, given more resources. I think there's still a long way to go, because like there's restaurants still, like there's not like as healthy restaurants as there are on the north side.
Lloyd said he thinks the south side has really come a long way in recent years in terms of restaurants, but he said there's still one thing missing.
They still don't have puffy tacos, which I'm like, make puffy tacos, like, because I like to order puffy tacos. But, and then they're building a bakery next door. So, like, stuff like that.
Millie Zepeda was having drinks at Mad Hatter's Tea House and Cafe with her friend when we asked her to tell us about the neighborhood she grew up in.
Can I still drink?
Absolutely.
Zepeda, who is finishing up at St. Philip's College, described what it was like growing up in what some consider a rough neighborhood near downtown San Antonio.
So growing up, there was definitely a lot of empty lots, a lot of
foreclosed homes, a lot of broken down, abandoned homes, not taken care of. And I would say about 2011, graduating high school, is when I started noticing the changes and people started buying lots and, you know, coming into the neighborhoods and buying these foreclosed homes and fixing them.
Zepeda mentioned that there are plus sides to these changes because it's good to see the neighborhood grow. But things used to be more affordable, and now it's become a more expensive lifestyle. Although the price increase concerns her and limits her ability to afford the same lifestyle, she is happy to see a community that used to be considered the hood become a better place to live.
Nothing like how it is now. Like, you see people jogging in the morning, and you wouldn't see that. You have a lot of, like Hackberry Street and Cherry Street, where you have all these nice condos, the Animal Dome, you have the Animal Brewery, Hay Street Bridge. None of that used to be. That used to be called Crackberry. That's how bad it used to be. That's where all the crackheads used to be at. Cherry Street also. It was, that whole area was bad.
Like Zepeda, Raymond Robinson has ties to St. Philip's College. He grew up in a biracial neighborhood right behind the college and still lives in the city's east side today. Robinson is a 63-year-old school teacher and coach who has seen a lot of changes over the years, but most of the changes he's noticed are in the children.
I came from an all-black Catholic school. It closed in 1967, so we went to St. Gerard Elementary that next year, and then for the next 4 years to the high school, which was, you know, which was a good experience. Met my wife there, and it's a really interesting place. The east side was at that time. I remember growing up not having to lock doors on cars or homes or anything else because you were safe. You felt safe. Of course, now all that's changed. Where I used to live, St. Philip's bought it out. So now it's I think if I'm not mistaken, it's a science and technology building. I wouldn't change anything about my growing up here. I wouldn't change it for the world. It was the best thing that ever happened to me.
As a father, teacher, and coach, Robinson knows what it takes for children to become successful and build strong character. He has this kind of commanding presence you'd expect from a coach, but Robinson shared some good-natured laughs as he talked about his own kids, which lets you know right away that he possessed the warmth and charisma needed to bond with his students.
It's different. It really, the public school system has to have a complete overhaul. It really does. And it's got to start, it's got to start with the parents. The first teacher you have are your parents. If they're not taught respect at that point, it's really hard to teach them once they get to us at that level, even pre-kinder and kinder. It's hard to find it. For the most part, my kids never went to daycare. They always spent it with my grandmother. And I have to give a lot of credit to her because she always talked to them. She always was telling them, you know, how to be an adult, how to be a good person. Same way she did me. Nona and I, my wife, we just kind of followed along with them. We're just blessed. I mean, when you have good kids, yeah, some of it is what you do and what you teach, but otherwise, most of it is a blessing from God. And I'm standing here and I'm laughing because I'm doing this interview with Joyce, and Joyce used to tell me, she said, every time I would see you, you had a belt around your neck. Well, there was a reason why, because there were four boys in the house, so there was a reason why. But they've all turned out to be good men, and I've got a daughter. They've all turned out to be good people, so that's all you can hope for.
We also had a chance to talk to Raymond's eldest son at a family crawfish boil. Brett Robinson is a 34-year-old school teacher, football coach, and basketball coach. He, like his father, hasn't noticed many changes in the neighborhood he grew up in, but he has noticed changes in people and the way children are growing up today compared to when he was a child.
Growing up was always great, just having people around. We grew up on the east side. We lived with my grandma for a while, and there was always about 20-some kids out in the street playing football, basketball. Kids now, they don't do that. I mean, we're outside. It's Sunday. It's in the middle of the afternoon. I know it's cold, but we were still outside. We just put more layers on, and we came outside. You know, you don't see that no more. You know, everybody, I guess, is kind of older. Everybody kind of moved out. As a matter of fact, I see one of the kids I grew up with, his son actually plays against our middle school. And me and him always talk about like how fun we used to have. And he's like, yeah, man. He said, my son doesn't even go outside anymore. Or, you know, they rather be inside playing video games. So that's something I feel like a lot of kids miss nowadays, is just being outside and interacting with other people. That's big for me.
Watching some of the kids run around the party and their parents chasing after them, Robinson feels like kids today are at a disadvantage, mostly due to all the conveniences they have and the way their parents pamper them.
I remember when I was young, you know, if you went to the movies with some friends or you went to the mall, you got some quarters. Like, hey, call me when you, or if you didn't, you spent your quarters at the arcade, now you had to problem solve. How do I get home? Or how do I call somebody to pick me up? How do I ride the bus? Those kids will never have that because they don't know how to problem solve. They just call somebody or they get Uber home. You know, that's something I think the world's going to miss is problem solving.
All 7 San Antonians we interviewed talked about change. Change in the neighborhoods they grew up in, but also difference in the way people approach daily life. They discussed how they felt about the adjustments they have experienced and seen over the years, and in some cases, what those changes might mean for future generations.
It's crazy and amazing. It's just like how fast did all of this change in front of my eyes.
Thank you for listening to San Antonio Connects. For multimedia storytelling at Texas A&M University San Antonio, this has been Mariah Gonzalez,
Oziel Trevino,
and Kevin Castro.